Good afternoon, everyone. Call the Senate Finance and Revenue Committee to order. I'm sorry I'm late. It's the time in the session when we are called to meetings that we have no control over. So today I need to leave, and Senator Morse will be taking the gavel at 2 o'clock. So I want to accommodate some visitors' flight schedules. I'm going to briefly open the hearing on the business energy tax credit, and then I'm going to recess that hearing, and then I'm going to open the hearing on Senate Bill 555 to hear from two of my colleagues. And then we will open the we will have the work session on Senate Bill 192 just to have the amendment described and maybe get a little bit of comment from the people who have participated in that. And then the balance of the meeting will be devoted to the business energy tax credit. Does everybody remember that? There will be a test. Okay. If I can remember it. Okay. Right now I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2472. Chris.
Good afternoon, Madam Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2472A makes a number of changes to the business energy tax credit. It establishes grounds for mandatory denial of preliminary certifications for projects exceeding $5 million that if they fail to meet certain criteria. Those criteria, it requires the applicants to have applied for all required state and local licenses and permits and not to be in arrears in any tax owed to the state or local governments, and to keep the facility in continuous operation for at least 5 years after it is placed in operation, at least in the eyes of the Department of Energy. It prohibits the Department of Energy from issuing a final certification unless all the permits and licenses have been issued and all of the other conditions have been met as well. It allows the Department of Energy, when considering an application, to consider the number of jobs created, the economic benefits, the revenue impact as compared with the projected benefits, and whether or not construction of the facility is dependent upon the preliminary certification. The bill would also prohibit the Department of Revenue from paying interest on amounts due to a tax credit claimed by a credit transferee upon filing an amended tax return. The bill also treats electric vehicle manufacturers as renewable manufacturing facilities for purposes of the credit, so they'd be eligible for the $40 million credit. And it reduces the project cost cap from $20 million to $15 million for renewable projects with an installed capacity greater than 20 megawatts, and allows the Department of Energy to consider multiple applications as a single application if the facilities are in close proximity or very closely related that they constitute a single facility. The bill also eliminates the automatic 10% increase in the credit due to higher than estimated project costs, and the bill would apply to preliminary certifications issued on or after the effective date of the bill. And you do have a revenue impact statement there that shows the combined effect of these policies would raise about $8.9 million in the 2009-11 biennium.
Thank you very much for that summary. I believe our out-of-town visitors who need to catch a plane are on the panel, Steve McClure, Gary Thompson, and Paul, looks like, Wooden. Welcome, and if you could all be as brief as possible so that you can get on your plane, because you're really pushing it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Steve McClure, Union County Commissioner. I've been a county commissioner for 19 years. Just briefly, I want to talk about the BSEE, particularly about the impacts it's had on our community. As most of you know, from the rural part of the state, the impacts of the endangered species listing have been severe on our communities out there. The wind generation programs that have come to Union County have had a tremendous impact on our revenue position. Union County currently collects about $3.5 million in property taxes. The Horizon Wind project that went into Union County generated almost 10% between the community service fee and the additional property taxes, so it's had a tremendous impact. We were talking about the possibility of having to lay off people 2 years ago. We knew that project was coming, so we didn't do that. More importantly, or just as importantly, there are other renewable energy projects that we're trying to do in Union County. We've entered into an agreement with a solar company that's going to do manufacturing in Union County. It's a startup facility. As most of you probably know, Union County sits in the middle of the Iron Triangle, the Wallowa, Whitman, Umatilla, and the Malheur National Forest, over 5 million acres of forest out there, tremendous opportunity for biomass opportunities out there. So I just want to emphasize that the BSEE really does have a tremendous impact on the rural parts of the state beyond just the wind energy. The last legislative session made a policy statement about how important renewables were to the state of Oregon, and we certainly understand, or I do, as a county commissioner, the struggles you have with trying to balance your budget. We're all doing that, and we're certainly sympathetic to that point of view. I would just like to stress that as you go through that process, that you look at it as that kind of an effort, balance your budget, but also look at the policies that you adopted and go forward with those policies. And my suggestion would be that if you have to make those cuts, you make them on a temporary basis with some kind of a sunset so that we can bring those projects back to the communities as time goes along. I think the House bill made some steps. We certainly support that House bill. But we would like to suggest if you go forward and you have to look at additional steps that we put together a small working group of people that are involved so that if we do make additional cuts, we can make them in a way that minimizes the impacts, spreads them off as evenly as we can so that we can move forward in a meaningful way to address the issues that you need to address and still look at the commitments that we have made to renewable energies in the state of Oregon. Be glad to answer any questions you have.
Thank you. We will direct questions to you and then excuse you so you can take off and hopefully make your plane. When you had your wind farm out there, you were under the BSEE credits as they existed before 2008.
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And that, I believe, was a $10 million cap and a 35% mm-hmm. share. And it was which company again?
Horizon Wind.
Okay, great. Yeah. And thank you very much. I just wanted to clarify that. Are there other questions from the committee? Okay, thank you. You can go now.
Thank you very much.
I hate to have people miss their planes on my Okay, who wants to talk next? And if you could be brief, we've got
first.
A lot of people. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is, for the record, my name is Gary Thompson. I am the Sherman County Judge. In regards to BSEE, currently the BSEE gives Oregon an advantage over other states. In order to save $20 million, we're going to give up that advantage. We're going to also lose additional jobs that are going to be coming to this state. Other states are looking at Oregon to copy our tax incentives. I've already been in personal contact with three states. They want me to, and my cohort here to fly to Arizona, Ohio, and Wyoming to give them insight on how to do tax incentives within those states. The idea that they'll come without the tax incentive is an incorrect thought. Oregon is not the best place in the world to put wind turbines. The only advantage we have is we are close to the grid. Also, Oregon is becoming more and more expensive to do wind turbines and wind stuff. Between the policies of Fish and Game and some of the policies of the state of Oregon, it is starting to get very, very expensive in order to even get a permit to build in Oregon. All I have to say other than that is we've got to be careful. We do need to have some type of working group where we can share this, work some kind of work this thing out so that, because I realize that you're looking for money and it's something to do. In order to balance the budget, we have to do it. So I really encourage a working group of some type.
Thank you very much. Questions?
Any questions?
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Paul Wooden. I'm Executive Director of the Community Renewable Energy Association. Our organization is a Oregon Chapter 190 intergovernmental group. We have a number of counties as members, colleges, government groups like McCog. We also have a number of small developers interested in community-scale projects. Community projects in Oregon are defined as projects 10 megawatts or less. It includes wave energy, biomass, small hydro projects for irrigators, and small wind, and basically any other small renewable of the 10 megawatt and below size. We do anticipate that based on federal activity taking place that the 10 megawatt definition may go to 20 at some point, but right now it's 10 in Oregon. I'm here to talk predominantly on behalf of small projects, but I'd also, if I have the time, like to spend a little bit of time talking about the impact of the large projects, because in Oregon I see that both have a place at the table and we try to help support each other.
If you could confine your remarks to the small projects that your organization represents, then we can call you back later if you want to add on.
Sure.
On the others.
Be glad to. One of the things I'd like to point out is that for most of you up there, you probably have people in your legislative districts working on small projects. They might be biomass, they might be small hydro and irrigation districts. If you're on the coast, it could be a wave. Pretty much every county in the state has people working to get smaller projects online. In Sherman County, you'll hear from a couple people, and Gillam County, that are working their own projects. The 2007 legislative session was a major milestone for us because in addition to the renewable energy standard, there were a number of policies put in place to promote small energy. All around the United States now, many of the states are starting to recognize that in addition to big wind, there's also a place for smaller renewables, and that the United States is not going to be just a big wind world. It's going to have biomass, hydro, and others. And the legislative session from 2007 is where the Betsy went from 10 to 20 million. It wasn't as much intended for large wind, although they benefited from it, but it was to put some additional financing into the smaller projects because it was believed the smaller projects have a disproportionate bang for the buck, if you will. It's pretty well known around the country that while the smaller projects don't generate near the amount of power the larger ones do, the economics on a per megawatt basis is greater because the revenues stay local in the community and it gives the opportunity for other diversity, distributed generation, and other benefits that help support the infrastructure. There's a lot of programs coming now in support out of the federal government, again, trying to recognize this advantage. So as we go down through this bill, like Commissioner McClure said, we were comfortable with the bill as it came out of the House committee. We have some concerns about what it will look like as it comes out of this committee. And we're prepared that if you do decide that you want to put together a work group to work with you to help come up with a policy that gets you where you need to be without crippling the smaller projects. So that's it for now. If you have any questions, and I'd like to come back for the large wind.
Great. Thank you very much. I'll put you back on at the end.
Thank you.
Thank you. Before we recess this subject, I am going to ask Kim McCabe to come up briefly and from the Oregon Economic Development Department. Then we'll get to you all. Welcome.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm here in support of the manufacturing credit for electric vehicles. As you all know, we've been very successful in this state in attracting the solar industry to this state. Solar World is erecting the largest solar manufacturing plant in the United States, actually in North America. But what you don't hear is all of the projects we lose. We tried to attract Schott Solar, also out of Germany. We lost to New Mexico. We've lost projects to Malaysia, to China, to Utah, to New York. We lose twice as many as we win. This Betsy tax credits are instrumental in helping us to win these projects, so I'd encourage you to include that in the bill.
Thank you. One of the real strong points of the solar world situation was the amount of permanent jobs, family wage jobs it created. How many jobs would you expect to see, in an electrical car manufacturing plant?
Well, if we're successful, Chair Burdick, members of the committee, initially when we're talking to the manufacturers, the first one is Think out of Norway. Initially, they'll employ 350. It would get up to 800 jobs. Those are good family wage jobs. They would be locating in the Freightliner plant that will eventually be vacated by Freightliner. So we're actually going to be rehiring most of the people that are already there. I mean, it's 1,000 jobs that'll be displaced, but hopefully we'll get back 700 of those.
Great. Thank you very much. Questions from the committee? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, now we are going to recess the hearing on House Bill 2472 and open a hearing on Senate Bill 555 for consideration of amendments. The bill itself is not what we will be talking about. Welcome, Steve.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. You have in your packet Senate Bill 555-1, which takes the content out of the bill and replaces it with what's in the amendment. The amendment is a change to the transportation grant in the school equalization formula. The language would make the transportation grant equal to 63% of approved transportation costs for all districts. Currently, that is a change from the percentage being 70% for 80% of the districts and then 80 or 90% for the other 20% of the districts, where the districts are ranked by cost, average cost, transportation cost per student. The highest 10% get 90%, the next 10% get 80%, and the remainder currently get 70%. You have a printout there, simulation 12, for the Dash 1 amendment, which shows the changes in the transportation grant. When the transportation grant decreases, the money will then flow into the general purpose grant in the formula. So it's not a reduction in revenue, it's just a matter of which grant is used for distributing that money. And so you can see the change in the general purpose grant there, and then you have to put the two difference columns together to get the net effect by district. And that's all.
Okay, thank you for that. And I have two of my colleagues here, Senator Monroe and Representative Cobb.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and members of the Senate Revenue Committee. Rod Monroe, Senate District 24, Senate co-chair of the subcommittee, Education Subcommittee of Ways and Means, joining me, Representative Betty Comp, the House co-chair. And this amendment comes to you with a recommendation from the Subcommittee on Education. Let me give you a little background. Looked into the history of transportation funding, and it really dates from 1990 when Measure 5 passed. Prior to that time, most school funding was through property taxes. Mm-hmm. Since that time, as you know, most of it's come from the state. And so initially what happened was they decided in the formula that transportation costs, actual transportation costs from school districts should be funded at 70%. And that decision was made at that time for all districts. Later on, somebody in power tinkered with that and decided to allow some districts an 80% or a 90% reimbursement for actual transportation costs. So now we come to today. There was a study during the last interim on transportation costs and the funding of transportation costs for school districts. They had all kinds of different scenarios that they looked at to some of them pretty radically change the way we fund school transportation. Our subcommittee looked at all of those and decided essentially to stick with the current formula. And so what this is an adjustment of the current formula to accomplish two things. First of all, if we're cutting basic school support by 10%, which we are, the EBL central budget level for basic school support puts it at over $6.5 billion. And you've seen the co-chair's budget, which in the best scenario funds K-12 at $6 billion. That's a 10% reduction. So it's a 10% reduction. If you do nothing but continue to fund all transportation costs at the current rate, essentially you are increasing the percentage of the school fund that goes to transportation. And we wanted to hold that flat, or hold it basically harmless for most school districts. If, for example, you're spending roughly 5% currently, almost exactly 5% currently, of the basic school fund goes to transportation, we wanted to keep it at or very near that 5%. To do nothing but cut the K-12 funding 10% below the EBL and leave transportation funding at the current formula of its actual costs, you would actually be increasing the percentage of the basic school support that goes to transportation. We wanted to hold it even. So that's why the 63%. If you take 10% off of 70%, you get 63%. Some of you are math wizards and got that figured out right away, Senator Telfer. But that's why the 63%. 63% essentially holds the vast majority of school districts equal in terms of the percentage of basic school support that goes to transportation and the percentage that remains for other education needs at 5 and 95. Now, the 80 and 90%, there are a few districts that are currently getting 80 or 90%. We found no justification for that other than political. And the reason being this. Small, tiny school districts do spend more per pupil on transportation. Many of them have to go out long distances into rural areas and pick up the students. But they are reimbursed at actual cost, remember. And 70% of that actual cost is more money than 70% of the actual cost in Portland, where they do practically no busing at all and get very little compensation. So it's still 70%. 70% of a higher cost is still 70%. 70% of a lower cost is still 70%. And then you drop that to the 63% so that the net effect will be that the percentage of state money in this that goes to transportation funding remains the same as under the current formula, with the exception of those tiny districts. One other thing about those small districts, they get small school compensation in the formula. There's a tweaking in the formula that pays a bonus to small schools. It just struck our committee. We could find no logical financial justification for giving some of them 80% or 90% because they're small. And so that's why this measure is the way it is. With that, I'd like to turn this over to my co-chair, Representative Comp, who has some other comments.
Welcome to committee.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Burdick and committee members. My name is Betty Comp, and I serve House District 22. And the good senator has stolen most of my testimony. You have a copy of my, hopefully you've been distributed my testimony that I've written. But what I would share is try to say what this looks like. I was looking at some reports from the Department of Education. And as Senator Monroe has shared, I looked at two school districts. One is Pine Eagle that has about 180 to 190 students. And they are one of the school districts that have been getting 90% reimbursement. What that breaks down to, again, is math, approximately $1,300 per student reimbursement. On the other side of that is Jewell, another small school district, has approximately 180 students. But they get 80% compensation for their actual costs. So that equates to $760 per student. There's quite a difference. And then just because I thought, well, is it because the distance people are traveling? Is it because they're small schools? I looked up Klamath County. Klamath County has approximately 6,500 students. And the data that I was using was from the school year 2005-2006, I believe. And Klamath County, which has one of the biggest geographic areas in the state for school transportation, they get the 70% reimbursement, and that's $307 per student. This is the range of the dollars, what it looks like to these districts. And so it's like I couldn't really put the pieces together to say, well, how can we justify that big of a difference in those costs? The other thing that has come up is that some people think, well, we're doing this because we want to do subcontracting out to school buses and not have unions have members participating. The reality of that is already 70 school districts already contract out, and we haven't gotten received the numbers of how many bus drivers are in unions or not in unions. You will probably hear some testimony today with maybe some of those figures. What we are trying to do is to create some equity between what's happening in the whole K-12 budget so that nobody, I mean, this is a time of crisis. We are not able to fund our schools, our health care, our safety issues in our society, and we felt we feel strongly that we need to do this in an equitable way, and we hope that that reaches that goal. And with that, we're available for questions, and would appreciate your consideration.
Thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Comp, could you repeat the, I think, do you have it in your testimony, the Klamath County versus the Jewell?
I did not print that. I didn't revise that, but the Jewell and Pine Eagle have approximately 180 to 190 students, mm-hmm. and Pine Eagle gets approximately $1,300 per student reimbursement. Jewell is 760, and Klamath County is 307.
Okay, and that's the difference between being 70%, which Klamath County is, and 80 or 90%, which those other two are.
Well, and Jewell is at 80%, and then Pine Eagle is at 90%. And members, what this does, it reimburses that, as staff said, there's the top. There's 40 districts that are at the top of this continuum, and the top 20 get 90%. If they spend, they're the highest spending districts, they are guaranteed 90% of reimbursement. The second 20 school districts are guaranteed 80%. And then the rest of them, rest of us, whoever they are, the rest of the school districts get 70%. And there is no incentive to lower your costs. The highest paying, the highest spending districts get almost full reimbursement. And so how, it's like we ought to turn that paradigm upside down and say, let's give, you know, let's give everybody 70% and take out the rewards for being or spending more. It just is a little upside down.
Okay. Thank you very much. Other questions from the committee?
Madam Chair.
I just wanted
to make a comment on the contracting out. I spent 10 years on the David Douglas School Board. David Douglas does not contract out. It owns its own buses and hires its own drivers, and that was my policy during that 10 years, and it's still followed. So I in no way favor school districts contracting out. My study of it shows that they get better service for less money when they don't contract out. But this bill has nothing to do with contracting out. This bill has nothing to do with changing a local school board's ability to make its own decisions about how it pays for transportation or anything else.
Okay. And Madam Chair, one other comment. Recently, when we were on our Ways and Means Road Tour, I had the opportunity to talk to the superintendents down in Klamath County, and they shared repeated examples about how they could try to conserve in their district. And when I saw this figure, because I believe they have their own bus fleet also, they I just can't say how much that they're doing to make sure the dollars get into the classroom. And when I saw the figure, how little they spend on transportation compared to others, it rang true. They are really trying to serve their students in the best way possible.
Okay. Thank you very much. Senator Morse.
Thank you, Madam Chair. In your evaluation, did you factor in what would be known in the business world as economies of scale, larger scale, lower unit costs, small scale, higher unit costs?
I looked at that very carefully and determined that those very small school districts generally travel further per student, have a more extensive bus fleet for the amount of students they have, and therefore are compensated at that level. Also, on the scale thing, that's why they get the small school compensation formula. There's a small school figure, Steve can tell you the exact amount of that, in the formula where we actually give small schools a bonus because they're small.
And Senator Morris, Chair Burdick, the economies of scale does come into the being of factoring this. I chose two of the smaller school districts that had smaller reimbursement than others. There's some districts up to $3,000, $5,000, $7,000 per student towards allocation, and this seemed more of a median, and so there is quite a range. There's a huge range in there. There's one school district that we do serve in Oregon that only has 3 students, and you don't want to know how much they get. Serious.
Okay, keep it secret for at least another couple weeks.
It's on here.
All right, thank you very much. Other questions from the committee? Senator Haas.
I just comment there. I think it's interesting. My school district, Beaverton, has the highest transportation costs of any district in the state. And maybe that's a commentary on the suburbs or our lifestyle or what. I don't know. But then they tend to lose more than anybody else under this change, just in terms of raw dollars. But I'm curious as why, if you know, why they, while not being the largest school district, have the highest transportation costs.
Obviously, the land use developments in Washington County are such that it makes it very, very difficult for children, young people, to walk to school. It's the way it's Washington County was developed around the automobile. It's simply a fact. I'm not being prejudiced. That's just the way it is. Cul-de-sacs and so on. And so getting young people to school safely by any other means than busing becomes very, very difficult. So that's why they have a much greater percentage of busing costs than other major suburban districts, for example. But remember that we're not stealing any money from Beaverton or anybody else. Every penny of savings goes right into the K-12 and is redistributed back. So when that redistribution of another $30 or $40 million takes place, Beaverton, because it has a large student population, will get a big chunk of it.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We are going to recess. We're going to put over the conclusion of this public hearing on Senate Bill 555, the amendment thereto, to next Monday. I don't see anybody on the schedule or on the sign-up list who is not here in the building. So I will put this over until Monday, just in the interest of time, so that we can spend the rest of the time on our other two issues. So we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 555 and open a work session on Senate Bill 192. And I'd like to have Mr. Kennedy Wong and Doris Pinwell, if she's around. Who else do we have? Roger Roper, come on up. I'd like you to be available for the presentation of this amendment. We have 4 chairs there. John Phillips, maybe you could come up too. All right. Dink.
Okay. Chair Burdick, members of the committee, Senate Bill 192-4 amendment completely replaces Senate Bill 192, so this is just standalone. Just to refresh your memory, this bill makes changes in Historic Property Special Assessment Program, requires property owners applying for a historic property partial tax exemption to submit and implement a preservation plan for participating property, and it establishes initial 10-year period of partial tax exemption, an application fee certification procedures, and reporting requirement. And it defines condominium in the context of the program and establishes qualification and disqualification of it. And it authorizes certification for second 10-year period of partial tax exemption. That's the essence of the bill.
Okay. Let's see. Who should we have summarizing that? We've all been involved. Roger, do you want to go ahead?
That's great. For the record, Roger Roper, Assistant Director for Oregon Parks and Recreation Department, and we administer this program and have for the past 34 years. The amendments, the Dash 4 amendments, are very similar to the Dash 2 amendments that you heard on April 21st, which were the summary of the Task Force on Historic Property, which was assigned to deal with this issue in the last session. The Dash 4 amendments, though, made a few significant changes to those Dash 2 amendments. One, they eliminated the extended term that was created as a way to resolve the inadvertent penalty that some people had when they came off the property tax freeze program. They were hit with a much higher tax rate. Turns out that's such a sticky issue because of Measure 50 and so on that it felt like that was maybe not something this bill should try to do to solve that. So that provision was let go. Two other things in these Dash 4 amendments. One is it reduced the term of the benefit from 15 years to 10 years. The final key item was that it required property owners or applicants to invest upfront a certain amount of money in the program, so it forced them to really get in and do something with their historic building and not just sit on it and reap the benefits. So there's a 10% spending requirement. That is 10% of the real market value of the property has to be expended within the first 5 years of participation in the program. Those are the key items that the Dash 4 amendments address that the Dash 2 did not. And I should reiterate, too, that the Dash included here and what was in the Dash 2 amendments was a solution to the condominium issue, where there was an overly generous benefit provided to condominium owners through no one's fault. It's just the way it played out over time. These amendments resolve that issue, and they would now be paying a more fair share property tax.
Okay, thank you. And I want to thank you for the summary, and thank you for your participation both in the task force that was working during the interim and I think came up with a very elegant solution to the condominium problem. And thank you for your follow-up help as we refined the good work of that task group. So thank you. Anybody else want to add in? Philip, you wanted to add one little thing to this, right?
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Philip Kennedy Wong, Multnomah County. Thank you for the opportunity to share with you the perspective of Multnomah County. And as you know, Multnomah County was very much concerned and interested in this bill. And we want to state, essentially, for the record, that we want to see this program continue. We believe it does serve a public purpose. And we are glad to see that there is some resolution that most of the parties could agree to. I would like to state that there are some issues with respect to the amendments that we believe that we can address in the interim and perhaps work together with the task force and other stakeholders to find essentially a better fit than what's currently being proposed. But we're not at this point, you know, going to oppose the bill. I would like to share with you what at least two areas in the amendments that we'd like to continue to work on with the task force and others. That has to do with the provision related to condos and also the use of the double CPR. And I brought with me our county attorney if you have any questions as to what this means for Multnomah County and why we would like to see continued work on this program.
Thank you. I think we probably won't do that today, but I talked to your chair yesterday and was very pleased to hear his support of the bill. And I'm glad we could work out something that serves the state as a whole and also accommodates some of the unique problems that Multnomah County has experienced with this. Anybody else want to add anything?
Just briefly, Madam Chair, members of the committee. I'm Doris Penwell from the Association of Oregon Counties. I participated with the myriad of stakeholders on trying to figure out what pieces of the various amendments we could pull together to be sure that we continue a program that has some sideboards on it that may not have had before. And I think we've accomplished that. And as Philip Kennedy Wong said, we can always continue to work on these things to make the program even better and stronger. One of the things about the program is it impacts counties and residences and commercial establishments differently around the state. Multnomah County happens to have one of the major impacts from the program, but in some other areas of the state, the difference between what the task force recommended and what Multnomah County recommended were almost nil. So it depends on the CPR in the counties and, you know, the market value and the assessment value and all those things. It's a very complicated thing. We looked at all that when we were trying to figure this out. So I think we're happy with it, and I know the Association of Counties are happy because they want the program to continue in some fashion that has these sideboards. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Anybody else have anything to add? Questions from the committee on the amendment or any of these witnesses that we have in front of us? Okay. We will close the public hearing on Senate Bill 192. And we will take a 90-second recess, after which we will reopen the Betsy hearing.
We have guests today that have traveled distances, and as is our policy, we will give them an opportunity to speak first. So the first three panels would be, a panel of three would be Kent Madison, we're having a problem here, Hildebrand and O-R-M...
That's my first name.
Oh, okay. Okay, so that's all one. Chris Mason, and... okay, we'll do that. Apologize.
No problem.
Okay. First.
Ormond Hildebrand is my name, Mr. Chairman and committee members. I am the face of a small wind project in north central Oregon out of the Wasco area. My brother and I have been working on this project for the last 5 years, and I'm here to tell you that we're in strong support of House Bill 2472-A. Our project will not go ahead without this. Think of me really as small business instead of small renewable energy. Our project, when it's in full construction, will spend over $5 million within the Oregon economy for goods and services just to get it built. We will spend each year $500,000 in salaries to support our project. This is salaries just for our project, not accounting services that we will have to contract out to support the project, but $500,000 per year. Without the Oregon Betsy in its current form, I can assure you we will not go forward. We have already invested more than $1.5 million in our project that we have spent with Tennyson Engineering out of the Dalles, Triaxis Engineering out of Corvallis, engineering companies such as Elcon in Portland, Oregon, Oregon Power Systems in Baker City, Oregon. This money is valuable to the local community. And we can show through studies from Oregon State University and the Minnesota State that investment in local community wind power projects such as ours return much more to the local community than the large power projects do. As a small business, I think we'll all agree that small business is a very important driver to the economic health of the state, and we want to see it go forward. But without the Betsy, it will not happen. Thank you.
A question of how large is or how small is your project?
9 megawatts.
9 megawatts. Okay. Any other questions? Next.
Sure. Yes, my name is Chris Mason. I'm the general manager of Mason Wind Farm Project in Morrow County, Oregon. And we've been working on our project for about 4 years, and we're there because of a very providential sighting of our family farms about 4 generations ago, very close to the Columbia Basin Rural Electric Lines, which are making small projects work if you're within about a 2-mile distance of a transmission line. And when we began our project, it was very much based upon the tax incentives such as the Betsy that we're talking about. I have to echo what Ormond says. Without these, our project simply will not go through. When I began this project, I was envisioning a small community wind, 10 megawatts, this sort of thing, which it does work economically. It's been proved to be such. However, we have found that in our specific instance, we have such, you might call it a perfect storm. Everything is matching up to be an extremely successful wind farm, but much more than just a small community wind. We are looking in the neighborhood of over 100 megawatts of wind, not on just our property, but with all the contiguous neighbors that will be able to come in and route their projects through our particular property. And we are looking at a new model for community wind that I would hope would be examined throughout the country when we're successful. And this entails small, locally owned projects that can come in a true cooperative basis. And Senator Morris, you bring up the perfect issue here, which is economies of scale. And that's what we are developing with our project, is an infrastructure which neighbors can plug into to make their projects a reality, which will return to the local community and the state the type of increased numbers that Ormond just mentioned with the small projects. So what we're looking at is basically the benefits of local ownership with the benefits of an economy of scale. And without the Betsy, this project that we're putting together simply won't fly. It just doesn't hunt. And I like to look at these type of investment incentives basically as priming the pump. And it's very difficult, if not impossible, for small community wind projects that will have a very substantial impact upon the overall economy down the road over a 20-year project. They just simply won't get off the ground. So I understand the need explicitly. On the ranch, we have to deal with questions of budgeting in order to make things fly, and I understand you do as well. But I would hope that we will have a small working group to go over these issues in detail so that we can explain how, from our points of view, some issues you can pull back on, some issues you can't. And on our particular projects, I think for most of us, the three of us at the table here, if we do pull back incrementally, often the project just simply won't work. So these are numbers that have to be examined very carefully, and I hope that we'll have a small working group. Thank you.
Any questions? With respect to the statement that it just won't work without Betsy, is that in the context of the bill that we have before us, or?
Oh, if the bill, I'm sorry. Yeah, I definitely support the bill. And if the provisions of the Betsy as they exist in the current bill are somehow reduced, that will be a deal killer on most of these projects.
We need stability within the state to help us provide the investment incentive for our outside investors to come in and invest with us. And with the jockeying around of the Oregon Betsy, the stability is not there. And that just by now has hurt us.
Timing is absolutely crucial in these projects. We have many modules that go together to structure a project, everything from the financing to availability of turbines, which has been a significant deal killer over the past many years. Things are just coming together right now that are supporting these projects. But if one component is unstable, it'll basically cause the whole house of cards to fall down.
Thank you.
Vice Chair, members of the committee. I'm Kent Madison. I'm of Madison Farms. I'm a third-generation farmer, and the fourth generation is at home managing today. At least they were when I left this morning. And I own a fairly large energy-consuming farm, basically, and we use about $1 million worth of electrical energy per year and up to 100,000 gallons of liquid fuel per year on our farm. And so I, several years ago, looked at ways to become energy independent or energy positive on our farm through liquid fuel and through the static electrical fuel. And it really didn't happen until 2007. In 2005, we started looking at the wind energy development across our farm. I mean, for years and years and generations, we cussed the wind blowing because the dirt always blew with it. And so we knew there was a wind resource there. We started looking at that. We found a developer that was interested in doing a small development that would allow us as landowners to actually build a project and own it, have our own turbine that we can go kick and see under our own name. And it really didn't happen until 2007, when the 2007 Betsy credits came along, when basically the state of Oregon said to us, we want renewable energy and we'd like to see it in rural America. That tipped our economics over to where it worked. We went ahead and built a project. We built a project that provided, I own, I think it was 4.95 megawatts or three 1.65 megawatt Vestas turbines on that project. The neighbors next to me also own some turbines. We're one of the only landowner-owned turbine projects in the country, very similar to what these guys are trying to do. We actually did it in the 07 and 08 timeframe. In May of 08, we applied for our Betsy application, and we waited the 60 days for the completeness review. The department never commented back to us, so we were assumed to be completed and reviewed on the completion, and we started financing it in August of 08, and we have turbines spinning today on our site, and they're generating electricity through the Pacific Core system. We support the legislation that's going on. We definitely support the Betsy concept. I built a biodiesel plant on our farm. We provide about 100,000 gallons of biofuels for the state of Oregon through that biodiesel plant. My pickup runs on B100 along with our tractors and everything else. We become liquid fuel positive, actually, in that status. And so we've asked Senator Nelson to submit in House Bill 2472-A25 to allow us to protect ourselves on our Betsy credits. We built this project based on the 07 rules, and we're trying to protect ourselves to make sure that we get our Betsy amount that we applied for, because we went ahead and built the project based on those rules. So we caution the committee on taking Oregon from being a very attractive place to develop renewable energies and a very positive place to develop those to a place that may be at a complete uncertainty, just like these gentlemen testified. If we tweak with this Betsy too much, we're going to drive energy and industries away from Oregon. This particular site on our place is a 64-megawatt facility now with multiple owners, and because we use the cooperative model that they're talking about and built this project. And it's actually got the wind resource now that we've discovered through the Betsy application. We actually got the wind resource now to develop about a $1.2 billion project on that area. So it's going to bring into Oregon, the Betsy application that we applied for is going to bring into Oregon way, way, way more than it's ever going to cost Oregon. It's going to be a very positive net gain for the state. So I would encourage you to pass Amendment A25-A25 as we submitted, please. Any questions?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Can you tell me how mechanically it works with those credits, where you take them, the certificates, the invest, how that really works?
We take those credits like I did in my biodiesel plant. We actually found an investor that was interested in buying them. In our case, we used Umpqua Bank. They were a bank in the Portland area that had a tax liability. We sold our credits to them, and we did some of those on the 35%. The first time when we first started, the cap was 35%. Then the cap was raised to 50, and we've actually sold them under both of those criterias. And we use that cash to then buy down our capital costs, because it just doesn't pencil other than getting that capital insertion back from some other investor that has the tax liability. We in ag don't have that big a tax liability.
So if I can, Mr. Chair, if you sold them to Umpqua Bank, for how much was it? What was the discount and how did that work?
It was sold, I think the first ones I sold was, this was in the biodiesel plant again, was at 25, I think it was 25.5% of the certificate. So if I had a $100,000 worth of certificate as an example, then I could turn around and sell that for, was it 25% of that, I guess it was, and get cash for it as opposed to 35% if I was to go ahead and keep it myself.
Right. So was it?
I used the pass-through option.
Okay, so it was $100,000, say, and Umpqua paid you.
They got the 35% certificate that they used to offset their tax liability, and then they passed. They sold that certificate back to me in the pass-through option. So,
for purposes of illustration, how much did on that one? Can you tell us how much you actually sold it for to Umpqua, and how much you got back, and what you were able to do with that? You sold it for Umpqua for how much?
For 25% of the, well, it was a 25% pass through. So if it was $100,000 worth of Betsy credit as an example, I guess I would have got $25,000 back if I remember right. I had to look back through my notes on how I've done five of these certificates, but on different projects within the state, but I can't remember the numbers, to be honest with you, looking at those certificates, but it definitely was the economic driver that tipped the projects to be favorable. When I went to my local bank and said I wanted to do this, they said it just didn't economically work. But with the Betsy credit pass-through option, it did work. So that's the thing. I think the take-home message is the Betsy credit option, especially in rural America where you have the pass-through option, makes those things viable to where we can, that we as small-scale developers can make them work.
And what did, Mr. Chair, if I may, what did the Bank of Umpqua get out of this?
They got, if they bought my certificate on April 16th and then it was good the next year, they got, I think it was about a 9% return on their investment, if I remember right. If they bought it on April 14th, and they used it on April 15th. They got like a 16 or 17% return on their investment because they offset their tax liability.
Senator, in the presentations we have made to various pass-through potential partners, first of all, the Oregon Department of Energy now sets the pass-through discount at 34.5%. So for a $1 billion BETC tax credit, we, our project would get $655,000, roughly. The pass-through partner can, pass-through partner can take that BETC, must take that BETC credit over a five-year period. So they don't get it all up front. And so the IRR on that BETC credit, roughly what we've been telling our pass-through partners, is about 14%.
Mr. Chair, I guess what I'm getting at is, wouldn't it make more sense, and maybe this isn't possible, for the state to grant you the full thing and cut the banks and the investors out?
But I can't use that amount, though. I don't have the tax income. I don't have the tax liability to that I can offset.
That's the same with us.
I mean, I need that BETC as part of our capital structure to get the project off the ground. That's what our finance partners, that's what the banks look at and say.
But still a subsidy from the state either way. And if the state's going to spend that to help you, what wouldn't it be more efficient and cheaper to cut out the investors and the middlemen, not just on this, but on other tax credit for different industries?
So if it's a tax credit coming directly to us, then, and if we don't have a tax liability, this is no good. If the grants say, if the state's saying we're just going to grant you money.
Forget about the tax issue.
Then from a developer standpoint, we don't care. What we're looking for is capital infusion to tip the economics over. We don't care if it's coming from UMCO, a bank, or it's coming from the state of Oregon.
Well, I guess, sorry for taking so long to make this point, but I think one of the very confusing parts, and I mean unknown to a lot of even maybe legislators, is that a lot of the beneficiaries of these tax credits that we have in our thick expenditure book are not the people that we're trying to help. They're investors. The film credit is one where an accountant or an investor will call and say, you know, we need $50,000, and they hand them a certificate. They'll hand them $40,000, and they'll get a certificate for $50,000 or an arrangement like that. And I'm just wondering if it makes more sense, it just for the state to grant with, you know, all kinds of requirements, the actual capital, than to go through this tax credit process that brings in banks and investors, whom also benefit and make these programs much more expensive to the state, or give you less than what you should get as kind of the net in all of this.
Senator Telfer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. If you were given a direct grant, you would you still be going to a financial institution or individuals for additional funding to do the project?
We would, yes.
Absolutely. Follow up?
Yes.
So then it doesn't matter to you whether you get it in the form of a credit and use that as the leverage in the bank because the bank buys it or whatever. It still costs X amount of dollars to provide the project. As far as where the funding comes from, I'm not sure whether a grant or a tax credit makes a whole lot of difference one way or the other. Other than the fact that if you had a nonprofit, I worked with the City of Bend, and we put one on a parking structure through urban renewal, but City of Bend doesn't pay any taxes, so they were able to sell and therefore finance the installation of some renewable energy on a parking structure. So it didn't matter whether they got a direct grant or a tax credit that they sold. They still converted it to cash, which went towards the project. So.
Mr. Chair, I, you know, this is like a whole different concept of how we do tax credits and probably out of the scope for this bill, but, you know, I, as much as I like your bank, they weren't doing this simply to help you or to help the state. And the same way that Walmart buys tax credits is because they have this liability at which they can purchase credits at a discount, essentially for the liability. And the state is helping those investors or the Walmarts or your bank or whoever it may be. And I just think that, you know, somewhere down the road we ought to explore changing that concept so that we're not leaving money on the table and subsidizing wind farms and banks and large corporations who are buying tax credits to lower their tax bill.
Senator, I think the thing that we want to emphasize is the needed stability that the state reflects to us as landowners or us as developers. As an example, in the 07 session, when the Betsy rules were written, we went ahead and developed our project based on those rules, and now there's some tendency for the state to now go back on those rules and say we want to make them retroactive, we want to change some things. We played by the 07 rules to develop our project. We spent our money, built in our budget, and the Betsy's under those rules were part of that budgetary numbers. And so the main thing that we're trying to emphasize is on the -A25 amendment is we're trying to at least hold ourselves, and we're trying to protect ourselves from having the state go back and say, oh, by the way, we're not going to issue you those credits when we built our project based on the 07 legislative rules.
Isn't there a process to certify and approve the
Absolutely.
Tax credits?
Yeah.
And you built the project without that certification?
No, we filed. We did it based on what the rules of at the time were, and those rules were if you applied for your certification and didn't hear back from the state within 60 days as a review process, then it was deemed to be good. And we built all kinds of projects, all my biodiesel projects, Sequential's big biodiesel plant, all those were built after we filed the application. So the application filing date was the trigger date before you could spend money. And so that's what we did. In fact, we even waited on the wind project. We waited 60 days longer than that, waiting for the state to call back and say, you know, we don't approve your application or we didn't pass the review. We never heard back from them. Back when we called them, they said there's no problems with it. So we went ahead and built after that point in time. Now they're coming, and we still haven't got our certificates yet. And they're saying, well, it's the backlog, it's the time frame, and, you know, the labor side and the department. And if that becomes the case, developers like ourselves or landowners like ourselves that are attracting developers, your guys' project, we won't have the stability. We can't go to the people and say, gee, we can build this. Here's how we're going to pay for it, because the rules are changing. So that's why we're in support of the -A25 amendment.
Okay. Well, I think we have more panelists, okay. Guests.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Excuse me, just 1 minute before you do leave. You were fairly clear in your communication that your projects won't work if the bill is amended differently or down. Do you have any data that you could share with us that gives us that information?
We can provide some letters from our equity investors. I mean, we lost a year. Because our Betsy was first approved with the certificate, preliminary certificate, made out to us in December 6, 2006. Then we had the problem with the Oregon State kicker. The Betsy market went down to zero. Our equity investors pulled out. We lost a year until the problem was corrected, and later on in 2007. I can provide that type of proof.
Well, I'm not suggesting or directing any specific, but anything that you can share with us that confirms what you're saying,
sure,
would
be
helpful. So
I can send that in.
That would be helpful.
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
We'll just go down through the list then. We have, let's see, I didn't call up Len Bergstein.
My client already spoke.
Okay, we're good to go there. Then Jesse Hunter and Suzanne Vetterloo.
Bonamici.
And Jody Weiser.
She's not here.
Do we have a senator in the room?
No.
Oh, okay.
All the time.
Okay.
Mr. Chair, committee, my name is Seth Prickett. For the record, I live in Portland, and I'm here representing the Oregon Solar Energy Industry Association. Our members brought up an issue to us that involves the ITC, which is the federal tax credit for energy renewable energy projects. And with the new federal stimulus, the federal government is giving us the option to go with a grant rather than the tax credit in an effort to boost the production of renewable energies across the country. And the issue here is that if you choose to take that grant in Oregon, you will be penalized under the Betsy application process. And so we have one of our members here to kind of speak onto that issue. And we're addressing the A26 amendments.
Okay. State your name and please proceed.
Thank you, Vice Chair and committee members. My name is Jesse Hunter. I'm a resident of Multnomah County in Southwest Portland. Thank you for the opportunity to give testimony in support of the proposed A26 amendments to HB 2472. I've come in spite of recovery from recent dental surgery, so please excuse any lisps. I'm an employee of a small solar installation company, Sunergy Systems. I work mostly with small businesses in the Willamette Valley. Our company is a member of the national and state chapters of ACES and SEIA. The A26 amendments are needed to correct an unexpected and unnecessary conflict between the Betsy and a provision within the Federal Recovery Act of 2009 promoting solar. Since 2005, there has been a 30% federal investment tax credit that can be taken by businesses who purchase solar equipment. This new federal provision allows businesses to now take a 30% cash grant issued by the U.S. Treasury in lieu of the investment tax credit. This law was made for those who otherwise would get the tax credit but do not owe enough taxes to benefit from the credit. This is especially important in today's economic downturn and as part of a national effort to move towards cleaner and non-imported energy. This tax credit, federal tax credit, and now grant have been a critical part in the major increase in solar and other renewables such as wind, but only in states that have their own strong incentives such as Oregon with its Betsy and utility rebates. The conflict lies in that the 50% Betsy basis is lowered by any federal grants, which normally would include such grants as the 25% USDA Rural Energy Program, but now would also include the Treasury grant, which simply replaces the ITC. Last year, we helped a Willamette Valley winery win one of the largest USDA grants in Oregon, without which the project wouldn't have gone forward. And also, if the ITC was penalized, as it would be right now, it also would not go forward. As an example, of $100,000, if this amendment goes through, A26 in HB 2472, on $100,000, the ITC is worth 30%, the Betsy is worth 50%, leaving 80%, covering 80% in incentives. This, if you take that ITC as a Treasury grant, it would be the same amount. However, without the A26 amendment, the 30% Treasury grant would effectively be cut in half because it is penalized by it penalizes the basis for the Betsy, which is 50%. And so you'd be 50% times your 30% means you only get 15% if you take it as cash. It effectively extends your payback, and so no one will be able to take it. Projects just won't be able to take advantage of the Stimulus Recovery Act. And so it'd be a shame for Oregon to bypass the advantages of this new act. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Thank you. I just want to confirm, the dash 26, A26, rectifies that.
Correct.
Okay, okay. I thought you were opposing the dash.
No, I'm okay. Very much in favor.
Okay,
thank you.
Thank you, Chair Morris. My name is Suzanne Lita Liu. I'm the Senior Policy Advocate at Renewable Northwest Project. Renewable Northwest Project is a coalition of public interest organizations, consumer and environmental groups, and renewable energy companies and affiliated companies. We work on wind, solar, and geothermal energy throughout the Northwest. I'm pleased to speak before you today. For one thing, I'd just like to state for the record, Chairwoman Burdick asked a question very early in the first panel that was before you about a project in Union County. And actually, the commissioner misspoke, so I just wanted to be clear for the record. The project that has been constructed in Union County is the Elkhorn Valley project. It's owned and operated by Horizon Wind Energy. And that project was under construction in the fall of 2007 and was put into operation in the winter of 2007. The significant changes to the Betsy, the increase from 35% to 50%, and the increase in the facility cost cap from $10 million to $20 million occurred in the 2007 session. So that particular project was able to take advantage of the increase in the credit. It was not based on the credit prior to 2007. So just for the record, I think it's important to just clarify that. There's also some questions related to jobs, and so I'll get to that in a moment. I think overall, it's really important to stress that the Business Energy Tax Credit has been an incredibly effective tool to attract capital for all kinds of renewable energy projects in the state of Oregon. And it's that ability to increase and direct that investment to Oregon that makes the Betsy essential. Overall, if you've had a chance, you can take a look at the EcoNorthwest report, and it shows that the Betsy has produced a 3-to-1 return on investment for the state. It's reduced carbon emissions by half a coal plant, so it's critical to attracting that investment here and attracting the right kind of investment that's clean investment for Oregon. And it's increased Oregon's total economic output by $576 million. In short, the bill that's before you today, 2472, was a bill that was developed over long negotiations and discussions within the House Revenue Committee. And while there are some cuts to the Betsy in that bill, in general, it's a bill that we think will have the least negative impact in terms of attracting Oregon's renewable energy companies to the state for development. So we strongly recommend that this committee not amend that bill further. If the committee is thinking about amending the bill further, which, again, we would not recommend, we think it's really critically important to do what some of the other panelists have encouraged, which is to put together a small working group so that you ensure that if you're going to do any further cuts, those cuts have the least negative impact on the long-term growth of the state's renewable energy market. And we want to be part of that process with you, with the committee, if it comes to that. It's also important to understand that for all these projects, but let's say wind in particular, we're talking about bringing a lot of jobs, both construction and full-time permanent O&M jobs, to the state. So, for example, we have over 1,200 megawatts currently operating in Oregon for wind, and about 2,300 megawatts in the pipeline. If we take a look just of a sampling of those projects that are operating in the state right now, it's over 1,000 construction jobs associated with building those projects. We're talking about projects that are roughly 800 megawatts, just as a sampling. That's about 450 turbines. So for each turbine that you construct, it's 800 man-hours for electrical workers. Another 250 man-hours, 800 man-hours for iron workers, another 250 man-hours per turbine for electrical workers, and then about 1,500 man-hours annually for operating engineers. In addition to those construction jobs, which are, again, really important, we also see about 70 full-time O&M jobs. And they're good salary jobs, both construction and O&M, and those construction jobs last about 3 to 6 months. So we are seeing significant job benefits both from renewable energy development, and I didn't even talk about solar, which is significant in terms of job development, and from manufacturing, and both are essential for the state's economic development. Finally, just in terms of the amendments that are before you today, the Dash 25s and the Dash 26s, we are certainly supportive of the OSEA Dash 26s, and it's important that they brought that to your attention. Regarding the Dash 25s, we believe that the intent of the Dash 25s is not reflected in the Senator's amendment before you. Unfortunately, this amendment, as we read it, would make the House, the cuts to the Betsy that were passed by the House, applicable and retroactive to all project applications that were beginning in October of 2008. So that is a major detrimental impact to projects that have applications into the department right now that are expecting a certificate at current levels. So we would strongly not recommend this particular language. Again, I think the intent of the senator is different than the language reflects, and we'd like to work with the senator and Oregon Wind Farms to help improve that. One final note. Again, overall, we would strongly recommend that this committee not pursue additional reductions in the Betsy, put together a work group to be able to discuss them. And one other thing, if there are going to be further cuts, the sunset approach is the best approach, because what you don't want to do is indicate that in the long term, Oregon isn't interested in attracting renewable energy development. I think that's the last thing this legislature wants to do. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you. Any questions or comments?
I have a question. Do any of you think we have too much renewable energy being produced right now?
Not by a long shot.
I would certainly agree.
Okay.
Jody Wise with Tax Fairness, Oregon. So 2742A is definitely a step in the right direction, but the co-chair's budget assumes that you're going to find another $14 or $15 million here. It's really hard to predict what happens with these projects because, of course, you can't decide how many different business owners will decide to build a wind farm or will bring a manufacturing plant to Oregon for solar or wind or electric vehicles. So any one of those things could wipe out changes you make pretty quickly. But under the bill that's before you, and I'm going to speak as though that's already been enacted just for simplicity's sake, we have reduced the subsidy for wind farms, the typical wind farm, from $11 million to $7.5 million. So there's been a drawback there. As far as we can tell, looking at the kind of subsidies in other states, but not really knowing what it costs to build a wind farm. You see what it says on a website, but actually today we heard numbers that reduced what we had read by from 140 to about $90 million for the same size facility. Using that $90 million cost for a 100-megawatt wind farm, our neighboring states that subsidize wind farms by using you won't have to pay sales tax, or we'll give you a rebate of the sales tax you paid method, are subsidizing wind farms of about 100 megawatts with something between $2.5 and $5 or $6 million. But we're not owning a wind farm, not knowing what it really costs to buy the machinery and equipment for them. We're really guessing. But someone said today they built 90 megawatts. They gave a price, and so we kind of played with those numbers. So some of our neighboring states are subsidizing in that range, and one other state tax subsidizes with a tax credit. Their tax credit is for 35% of cost, and it is not marketable. So it's really, as you heard today, a lot of them are using the marketing of the tax credits as part of the business design when they're buying things. I think that Senator Haas brought up a really important point. We are losing money because we're giving tax credits rather than grants. If we had been using grants since 2005 and we had passed out to the producers or the manufacturers the same number of dollars as they actually got, we would have an extra $84 million right now. And there are currently, just from 2005, $200 and some million worth of tax credits that are waiting to find pass-through buyers. So that remains an issue. How do you find the partner to do it with? And why would we use a tax credit for $100 when we could give the business $75 and accomplish the same good for that business? It's poor public policy, but it's probably not for this session, because how that interacts with projected revenue gets really messy. And so we'll probably want to do that when we have more time to really consider how to go about doing that. There are some things, some ways that seem like they would be the easiest way to find the savings that you're kind of been charged with finding. One would be to reduce. We went from 35 to 50%. You could reduce the subsidy to 40 or 42%. I mean, we just choose these numbers, and we could choose a lower number. We would be spending less per project. We could change our caps and be spending less per project. Or we could come up with an idea that says so much per job, or so much, if you're thinking only of energy production, so much per megawatt produced. Or the system that the U.S. government uses for much of its subsidy, which is just how much do you produce? What did you build? Not how much did you spend? Not what was your capital expense? But we'll give you so much every time you create some energy. So those are all rather complicated. Probably the easiest ways at this point would be to change the percentage or change the caps. So you might go from the 50% to 40%. Or you, instead of, we currently have caps at 15, 20, and $40 million. So 50% of 15, 20, and $40 million. You could make that caps of 10, 15, and $30 million, and that would bring your cost down. You won't really know for sure what you're going to gain because you can't guess. In your packet, you can see what's happened. The page that looks like this, you can see that on the first page, we were not using much tax credit money for wind. This is what was awarded through 2006, beginning in 2006. The top of the second page, you'll see that we've got more. You know, in 2006, we had projects that totaled, it looks like there are four projects. And then we passed the renewable portfolio standards. And they said you have to have clean energy. You have to get it by 25% by 2025. And we changed our subsidy from basically $3.5 million to $11 million per wind project. And you can see what really happened. You see that in 2007, we probably will have passed out on projects started that year, $66 million, and in 2008, there are eight projects in line. And that's what we're looking at, this kind of mushrooming of growth that has some advantages to the rural counties, but doesn't have many advantages to the general fund itself. We hear about how much energy these wind farms and the biomass facilities are doing for rural counties. And the next page in your packet is a page from Suzanne's organization. And I developed this next two pages back in March, and I think you have more recent data on your website now, but this is what was on the website then. And so you can see that it says in the green section there, the number one is, that there were 954 megawatts of new wind power in the Pacific Northwest. and now we have about 1,000 megawatts in Oregon. So the claims here are similar to what you would hear just for Oregon. So it really doesn't matter what the capital investment is, because most of the equipment is coming from outside of our state that's being installed at this point in time, so that the amount of machinery you buy doesn't really do anything for our economy if it's bought in Colorado or China. It says it brings $2 to $3 million in royalty payments to landowners. But if you look at, well, what if there's $2 or $3 million in royalty payments to those landowners, what does that bring in income taxes? If the landowners actually pay taxes on all of that money, it brings in $270,000 a year in new income taxes. To spend $100 million to get $270 million in income taxes isn't a really good buy. That's not the kind of investment most of us would make. It says that it's going to bring in roughly 80 jobs. Well, 80 jobs at this price is about $1.2 million per job. That's a very high price to pay for jobs, and our $11 million investment was paying for the jobs, if they were $70,000 a year jobs with benefits and salary. It was paying for the first 17 years of those employees. That's kind of silly for us to pay for the first 17 years of the employees for a new business. And the other claim is it increases property taxes in the rural counties. It does increase property taxes in the rural counties, but if that's our goal, we could just give the $11 million, or now $7.5 million, to those rural counties directly rather than have it kind of pass through this other thing, because they say they will receive $10 million over the next 20 years from just one project. Well, that's not a great return on investment either. And so we really have to look at, do we need to be doing this? Are we competing with our neighboring states, or are we over-competing with our neighboring states? Are we giving more than is necessary? We're not getting growth that is higher than our neighboring states.
Jody?
Yes. Have we reached our time?
I apologize. I haven't managed the schedule here very well, and we have several folks.
After me.
Yes, and we have committee at 3 o'clock, so
okay.
We will have to...
Can I direct you to page 5 of the bill, to the part that is not changing? And there you can see that there are, for instance, some things you put in place in other years. One of them says that if the economic forecast is down, the director of the Department of Energy might not spend all the money it says it would spend on renewable energy manufacturing facilities. We have met the criteria for the down market. Do we know if the Department of Energy is reducing what they pay, what they hand out? And do we want to say they shall, or they may, or they shall reduce what they pay out?
Yeah. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
And I apologize. Thank you, panel. Apologize to John Ahrens, who did travel farther than 100 miles, and I did not recognize you with the first panel. John, if you would come up, and if Len, if you could come up and respond to the Dash 25s.
Actually be the one who does that, if that's okay.
That would be fine. Maybe if we very quickly respond to the Dash 25s. Do they do what we think that they would do, or the intended?
The bill that exited...
Excuse me, your name.
Glenn Ikemoto, Oregon Wind Farms.
Okay.
We arranged the financing for Mr. Madison's project.
Mm-hmm.
The bill that left the House provided a transition rule, which said that any projects that had preliminary certification on the effective date, which was 91 days after the adjournment of the legislature, would fall under the existing rules. So the House version says, if you have preliminary certification by the effective date, you fall under the old rules. The problem with that is that it relies totally on an action by the Department of Energy, which itself has created some delays and some problems. So, some of our projects are caught up in that. We have asked the Legislative Council to draft some language which would rely on an action of the project sponsor, not the Department of Energy. And so what we proposed was, in addition to what the House authorized as a transition rule, in addition, that any projects that submitted their applications a year before the effective date would also fall under the old rules, whether or not the Department of Energy had taken an action. So Schedule Dash 25 actually expands the transition rule that the House provided to projects that had applied a year in advance and had either not had action or had a disputed action. So it's not intended to restrict the transition rules more than the House proposed. It actually broadens it slightly.
Okay. Thank you very much for that explanation. Please state your name and
Vice Chair Morris and committee, my name is John Arns. I'm the Executive Director of Mid-Columbia Council of Governments. We provide services in Hood River, Wasco, Sherman, Gillum, and Wheeler counties. We also have other programs in Grant, Morrow, and Umatilla. So we have a very rural footprint, if you will. I've been involved with community renewables for the last 4 years, and it's very, very important that the state maintain a BETSI program. It's roughly 35% of the funding source for community renewables. It's a very, very important piece when you try and put these projects together. Let me speak just briefly about training and jobs. In rural Oregon, when you get out into the hinterlands where you've got a county of 1,900 individuals, and for the last 30 years, there's been an exodus because of population, because there has not been job opportunities for youth. The wind farms are providing jobs for the youth. It's providing them the ability to stay home. Maybe it's partly working on the farm. Maybe it's partly going to work as a turbine tech. We assisted the Columbia Gorge Community College in their efforts to get the renewable energy technician program up and running. It's the only congressionally recognized wind program on the West Coast. They just started their second cohort this last spring, so they're putting out about 68 individuals a year now as trained workforce with a one-year certificate or a two-year degree. These individuals are working in our communities. There's an opportunity for probably about 600 additional technicians as we know the market today east of the Dalles. So there's great opportunities, and I know that you're short on time, so I'll stop my comments at that point and answer any questions if you have any.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, sorry I crashed the podium here.
No, that's quite right.
On John's coattails, but I couldn't resist. Over the last 3 years, I've chaired the Renewable Energy Work Group and recently became co-convener along with Bill Thorndike of Medford. Mike MacArthur. Sure. In this capacity, I'm the chair of the Renewable Energy Work Group. Sorry. A couple of points I wanted to cover. Senator Haas was asking about the way the BETSI operated, I think, and versus just a grant. We talked in the 2003 session about a program which would use future lottery revenues, create a grant program. Couldn't get that to work politically here. The beauty of this program is the developer gets their money up front to do the project. They get the cash from the pass-through partner, and then they get their tax break over 5 years. So the time value of money has to be calculated there, where the money comes up front and the break comes later. One of the things the Renewable Energy Work Group worked on last interim was the Renewables Portfolio Standard, and we developed that program, which was adopted by the legislature. In doing so, we promised the industry, we promised the developers, there would be tools for them to use. And one of those tools is the Business Energy Tax Credit that was passed to the level it is now along with the RPS. So my point here is those things go hand in hand, at least in terms of the policy that was adopted by the legislature in the 07 session. So I urge you not to damage that tool. It's very important for us to be able to reach those renewable portfolio standards that were set, which is our goal to move towards renewable energy for a variety of reasons. I think what you heard today about community projects is also very significant. And we've learned that in the Midwest, at least, there are lots of locally owned community projects. In Oregon, it's been very difficult to get any started. We tried to do that in Sherman County for a number of years. But to hear them have one that's operating, several more in the pipeline, right on the verge of being able to go forward, but needing the Betsy is really significant, I think. Because I think that's the real sweet spot in investment for Oregon, to have locally owned projects. What John just emphasized here about creating jobs locally. Just going back home to Sherman County, I talked to my neighbor the other day whose son-in-law was laid off in a mill in Halsey, found a job on a wind farm, Iberdrola, in Sherman County, moving the family back to Sherman County. And I think those are the kinds of stories we're going to hear more of as this industry develops. So on behalf of the work group, this is essential part of the Renewable Action Plan, and I urge you to do as little damage to the Betsy as possible. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. We've got 5 minutes. We'll do the best we can here. Brian Doherty, Ken Henschel, and Dan Eisenbeis.
Good afternoon, Chair Morrison, members of the committee. Brian Doherty here representing Invenergy, Inc. I am passing around to you a worksheet of a project in Eastern Oregon. You've heard a lot of numbers today, and I don't want to confuse them more, but I do think you could look at an actual project and see what returns are coming from these projects, and I'd be happy to talk with you folks more after session at your office and explain some of these benefits. The key thing I want to mention, Invenergy is a company that has built this Willow Creek project on the Gillam-Morrill County border. To answer Senator Haas' question, I think as a developer, getting a grant or getting it through pass-through partners is fine. I think the legislature decided a direction. One of the key things, Oregon is 27th in wind profile and is 7th in wind production. The Betsy is the reason. There are other states with better wind, but the Betsy makes a difference. And I'll give you an example. Invenergy was working on a project in Vantage, Washington. The Washington sales tax credit, which they just talked about being somewhere in the $2.25 to $5 million range, they eliminated Washington, eliminated the sales tax credit, I understand, and Invenergy is no longer looking in Washington. They are that close. Our wind profile in Oregon is about 30 to 35%. In Montana, it's like 55%. But by the time Montana gets it to somewhere that can use it, it's down to 30% again because of transmission issues. The second thing I want to emphasize that you heard here in the investment community, certainty is the key. If there's a doubt about the Betsy, they zero the Betsy out in the project. If there's certainty is key. If it's certainty at 10 or 15 or 20, wherever it is, certainty is very important in the community, or they just, it's a zero for that factor if it's not something they can reasonably ascertain. And that can cause projects to end. And I don't know, Senator Morris, you mentioned real movement from 15 to 10 and a project. I can't say that. I can say that we are very close on that win number about what makes it work and what doesn't. And the effect we'll only know later about whether they add it up. They look over at projects in Montana, Idaho, and look at Oregon. They say the Betsy is at this. Does it work or does it not? But I think we're getting very close to that with the numbers that we have here. I also believe that a sunset after the 2011 legislature of these changes would be appropriate, again, to give the signal that we intend to review this and we intend, if the economic times are better, to again encourage this investment. Also, you have this less than 20 megawatt solar. I represent a solar developer, Obsidian. Those numbers, those small projects, the reason that the House put that in, that exempting under 20 megawatts, is because it is particularly critical for those smaller projects to have this Betsy credit. A project that is a $200 or $400 million project needs the benefit less than a 20 megawatt project. And that's why we've capped it in many places. Anyway, I will not go on. I'll be glad to talk to you about some of the benefits. You'll see that if you look over a 15 to 20-year term, you're seeing a lot of money for that $10 million that the state gave up over 5 years. You're seeing an awful lot of return here to local farmers, and perhaps more can be got to the state, accrue to the state in a project like this. But I'd be happy to answer any questions, and thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Who wants to go next? We're running very short of time, and I apologize.
Thank you.
Please proceed.
Vice Chair Morse, Senators, my name is Ken Henschel. I represent Extra Effort Consulting and Supply, a Washington County-based small business. Unlike most of the previous speakers, we're on a different side of this of the whole Betsy and energy conservation. We work with existing buildings to help them save energy. As a contractor, as a consultant, as a distributor, we go into existing facilities and find opportunities to get them a good payback and return on investment, say, with a lighting retrofit. And at the end of the day, the Betsy tax credits are hugely important, the main credit as well as the pass-through. And I have no issues with most of the bill. There's just one part of it that really affects us, and I wanted to bring it to your attention. It's Section 5, Item 4. And it's the section that I believe the designers of this bill put in to try to save money. It has to do with the 10% overage that can occur on a Betsy application. And why I'm concerned about that is there are many reasons why that overage happens. We submit a preliminary application to the DOE, as an example. And so at some point down the road, we get back the approval to do the project. And that might take up to, it has taken up to 16 weeks. During that time frame, we have changes in material pricing. We have changes in freight terms. We have changes in the price of gas for freight. Things happen during that time period. And if you cut off that ability to go over by the 10%, it really affects us quite a bit. And because those are important pieces of the project, and sometimes the DOE is the one causing the backup. As well as you run into things on a project that you don't expect. Maybe you're counting light fixtures in an existing facility while it's operating. People are there. Machinery is there. You miss a couple fixtures behind a column. You need to be able to do those fixtures and retrofit them and still be able to claim it. The owner will get billed for it because he'll want it done. But if the Betsy credit stops at the preliminary certification amount, that really impacts the owner. So accounts can do that. And you run into things that you don't know. If we were retrofitting the light fixtures in this room, for example, we don't know what's behind that light. Is it a standard ballast or is it a PCB ballast? Handled very differently. Yet we can't go in and inspect every fixture ahead of time to figure out what's in it. So we would typically quote the amount of the project and so much of ballast for overage on PCBs, just as examples. So there are many reasons why we can go over, and that 10% is really necessary for us and for our end-user clients. In addition, what I worry about also from the point of view of the Revenue Committee is if you knock out that, or if this bill knocks out that ability to go over by some amount because we don't know what the costs really are up front, what I worry will happen is when contractors and end users submit jobs to the DOE projects, they will just pack those prices in up front. So instead of a $10,000 project, maybe it will be submitted as $11,000. And at the end of the day, the revenue that you're expecting to generate by eliminating that 10% overage, I don't think is really going to happen because everyone's going to try to protect their interests. We've had many projects we've submitted that have been nubs on what we expected them to be. We have some that have come in low. We have some that have come in over. Please don't.
I might interrupt you.
Yes.
Senator Hass and I are on the same committee. He chairs and I vice chair that committee that starts promptly at 3 o'clock.
Okay.
And so I would ask if you could maybe put your thoughts in writing and get them to the committee. And Dan, this is not the last hearing. If you would feel comfortable coming back, you're looking at a committee of one here, so it's...
I would be happy to return at a later date.
Pardon?
I would be happy to return at a later date.
Okay. And I had, unfortunately, I think I had Martha Pellegrino also that I missed. Otherwise, I think I got everybody that was signed up. But we'll be bringing this back, and if you could give us, because your information is helpful.
Thank you.
So, and I apologize, Dan and Martha. So with that, we'll close the hearing.